familiar with the idea of repeating positive daily affirmations, and that the term hypnoaffirmation made the parallel between these two practices clear. We are using positive phrases that are easy to remember so as to condition the subconscious mind. Hypnoaffirmations are infinitely more powerful than affirmations alone, though as they reach the subconscious mind directly, without the massive impediment of the conscious mind standing in the way. With this simple self-hypnosis process, you are marinating your mind in the kinds of thoughts and feelings you desire to operate from in life. You are taking time to overpower the mainframe that can so often be negative and reactionary. You are now proactively coding your subconscious to be happier, lighter, more empowered to be free. Next steps. Excellent. You have completed your first self-hypnosis process. Now go ahead and visit www.closeyoureyesgetfree.com to access this chapter's hypnosis recording. Pop in your headphones, sit back, relax, and close your eyes, get free. Using the hashtag closeyoureyesgetfree on Instagram or Twitter, message me at GraySmithTV your starting and ending numbers on the stress scale. By using the hashtag, you'll get to see how other readers are improving right alongside you. Plus, I will have an opportunity to cheer you on. Move on to chapter 2, and in the meantime, look out for all of the wonderful benefits you're already starting to receive as a result of learning the power of hypnosis. Chapter 2. How Our Habits Were Formed. Jill has big doe eyes. When you look into them, you feel as if you're falling into a portal, transporting you to a place that's deep with knowledge. She also has a beautiful, endearing smile. She was always immaculately put together, but without seeming to care about her appearance in a self-absorbed way. If a strand of hair was ever out of place, it didn't look messy. Instead, it seemed to spark an air of adventure, rebelling against the rest of the neat ponytail. She was the type of woman who had so many truly close girlfriends that she was a bridesmaid at least 3 times per year for close to a decade. She was a true friend. When she communicated, she checked in fully, writing a long message. She was somehow completely devoid of jealousy and meanness. Even though she exhibited a great deal of happiness with everyone else, trouble was making its way through her system, starting in her stomach, a breeding ground for worry. It snaked up her spine and out her mouth, which she would fill with her fingers and then bite. She chewed her nails and cuticles until they bled. She chewed them even though her mother made a face every time she did. She bit them even though everything about her was meticulous and ironed and looked as though she was going out for brunch in the Hamptons. She bit them even though the cuticles embarrassed her to no end. She couldn't stop, and she didn't know why. She had developed the habit at a very young age, as many people do. She couldn't remember a time when she didn't bite her nails. At the age of 24, Jill decided to seek out hypnotherapy as a possible solution. A friend of a friend had used hypnosis to quit smoking with success, so she thought it was worth a shot. On an unusually warm New York day, she walked into her first appointment with her hypnotherapist, Mary. Her hesitation showed because she was almost 10 minutes late. She apologized for her tardiness and held her imaginary armor close as she sat down in Mary's office. Mary smiled to herself, knowing that this kind of body language was common during the first session. It was apprehensive, closed off, and, while kind, definitely skeptical. It was in stark contrast to the body language people would show during their second and third sessions, once they knew that hypnosis is nothing more than meditation with a goal. "So, how can I help you today, Jillian?" Mary asked. "Oh, you can call me Jill," she said, as her body started to wriggle around in her chair a little, a sign that her body was attempting to get comfortable with the idea of sharing her feelings with a stranger. She looked up, and Mary was smiling, waiting patiently. Jill smiled back and uncrossed her arms before continuing. Well, honestly, everything is pretty good. My job can be really stressful sometimes, but overall, I really have very little going wrong. I'm not even sure if you can help me. You see, I have one thing in particular that's really holding me back. It might sound silly or small. I kind of feel bad for making such a big deal out of it. I'm sure you help people with much bigger problems, but it does bother me. Jill paused and looked into Mary's eyes. I've been biting my nails for years and I can't stop. I've tried everything. I put horrible tasting stuff on my fingers. I even tried wearing gloves. I know it's gross and unsanitary. Since I can't stop, I feel really weak and that makes me so sad. I didn't think I was going to be a weak person. After another big breath, Jill began to sob. Mary held space for Jill, letting her know in a soothing voice that the tears were an important emotional release. Just let them keep on flowing for as long as it feels good to cry, she said. After a few minutes, Jill took a few deep breaths, began wiping away the tears, and grabbed a tissue from an oversized box on the table next to her chair. She let out a little laugh. I guess this happens a lot here, huh? Mary laughed. You could say that again. It's wonderful because letting out all of that pent-up emotion allows us to get to the root of this even faster. You see, the nail biting is a symptom. It's not the problem itself. It's how your system is choosing to cope with something else. Jill stared off into space and said, "That makes sense, but what is it then? What's the bigger problem?" Mary smiled and said, "Let's find out, shall we? First, you're going to relax deeply. Once you're relaxed and feeling safe, you'll become more open to suggestions, but only those suggestions you want to be open to. In fact, the more you want to be open to them, the more open you will be. Does that make sense?" So no clucking like a chicken? Not unless you want to cluck like a chicken. And even if you do, I'm not sure that would be a good use of the money you paid for this session. They both laughed. At this point, Jill's body language relaxed. She closed her eyes and took a nice, deep, letting go breath. Within a few moments, Jill was in a comfortable theta brainwave state, the sweet spot between the beta brainwave, which is fully awake consciousness, and the delta brainwave, which is sleeping. Mary then asked Jill to return to the very first time she ever bit her nails. All of a sudden, Jill was little Jilly Bean, sitting in her kindergarten class. She described to Mary how music was playing in the classroom, and four desks were arranged in little clumps throughout the room, all facing each other. They were supposed to be coloring silently, and Jill was having a great time running her brightly colored crayons back and forth across her paper. All was going well until Julia, the little girl next to her, started asking Jill questions in a loud whisper. Jill whispered back, "We're supposed to be quiet." But Julia kept at it. "Why aren't you coloring in the lines? Why didn't you wear pink today like always? Did Mrs. K say we were going to lunch soon?" Exasperated and terrified of getting in trouble, Jill whispered loudly, "Please be quiet." A hush came over the room as the squeak of the teacher's chair across the linoleum floor indicated Jill's worst fears were coming true. Mrs. K, not known for her gentle touch, came over and yelled at Jill for being a bad little girl. She told her the directions were simple, to color silently, and that Jill couldn't even follow the simplest instructions. To add insult to injury, Mrs. K then took the picture Jill was coloring and pinned it up on the blackboard. "This is a reminder to follow the rules because Jill couldn't," at which point the students laughed and pointed at her picture, making comments about how she didn't even color within the lines. Tears began to run down Jill's face as she described to Mary how little Jilly Bean felt in real time. "My face feels hot, my heart is beating so fast, I can't really think clearly, and, oh my God, my hands are under the desk and I'm picking my cuticles." "That's right," Mary said, And have you ever done this before? No, this is the first time I've ever picked at my nails and cuticles. I just don't know what else to do. Everyone is looking at me. The session progressed and eventually included inner child healing by inviting adult Jill, the beautiful grown-up woman, to have a conversation with Mrs. K and share how this form of public embarrassment had traumatized her. During the conversation, Jill could see with adult eyes how tired the teacher looked. And she was able to feel compassion for Mrs. K while strongly disagreeing with her teaching style. Adult Jill was able to kneel down next to little Jilly Bean and tell her how much she loved her drawing. And little Jilly Bean was able to remind Julia, the little girl next to her, that if she had a question, she should ask the teacher since whispering wasn't allowed. When the session ended, Jill blinked a handful of times, becoming aware of her surroundings. Then she sat forward in her chair and said, "I had no idea. I had no memory of this until today. This makes so much sense. I feel so bad for little Jilly Bean. I can't believe how cruel Mrs. K was to her, to me. But I feel badly for Mrs. K too. I'm so happy we did this. I feel so much lighter now. I can't thank you enough. I'll be back next week." Right away, Jill found a dramatic increase in her overall confidence, and her nail biting decreased significantly from multiple times per day to a handful of times per week. This, in and of itself, after one session, was fantastic. Over the course of 5 more sessions, Mary and Jill worked on conditioning, a key component to maximizing the benefits of hypnotherapy. Simple phrases such as, "I am safe," "I am calm," "I choose to be here," reconditioned her subconscious to be less anxious and calmer. Sipping water was offered to the subconscious as a replacement to nail biting, and eventually the habit stopped altogether. For months on end, Jill was free from the habit that had caused her so much pain. After a few months, the habit did return sporadically, usually during a particularly stressful week at work, but never to the same extent as before the hypnosis sessions. Jill understood that the nail biting was a symptom, not the problem, and that if it came back, it was her body signaling a level of stress that was seeking an outlet. Jill now thanks her body for letting her know, pops in her headphones, closes her eyes, and gets free. As I mentioned in Chapter 1, I begin each chapter with a short story for a very simple reason. Stories are hypnotic. They help us ease into a focused, relaxed, imaginative state, and we can remember information that we learn while in this state rather easily. I'm sure you can remember the premise of your favorite novel from childhood much more easily than you can the contents of a heavy textbook. And I imagine the stories from this audiobook will stand out in your memory as well. Why are we creatures of habit? I want to stop. I really, really do, but I just can't. Even though I know it isn't good for me, I just can't seem to stop. Sound familiar? It could be nail biting as it was for Jill. It could be overeating. It could be shaky hands while public speaking, procrastinating, smoking, or yelling at a spouse or child when it's the last thing you want to do. It's painful. Saying we're going to stop, promising ourselves and others that we're going to stop, giving our word, making resolutions, and then nothing. It adds insult to injury and often impacts self-worth in a big way, which, as we'll discuss in later chapters, only makes the cycle more difficult to break. How did we get here? How is it that the most evolved species on the planet can't just, for example, give up coffee if it makes us jittery, or practice a new language every day for just 1 hour when it's something we really, truly want to do? It all comes down to habits, and habits live inside the subconscious. Human beings develop habits by learning to mimic from a very young age. This is the way we learn how to be a human within the cultural context in which we grow up. It's why we have the accent or mannerisms that we do, or why we think certain things are rude. We're very much conditioned to be the kinds of people we grow up to be. Certain habits are actively taught, and other habits are absorbed. If someone grows up watching TV with their parents, depending on what the evenings were like, TV could subconsciously be linked to the idea of love, connection, feeling safe, and being together. Or TV could have been an escape from an otherwise unpleasant or scary experience at home. Strong sensations like these, good or bad, aren't easy to overcome. The aim of this chapter is to show that you are a combination of what you were told, what you were shown, and what you decided for yourself. Unfortunately, without sincere effort on our part, what we decide for ourselves usually loses out to the others. This is because very few of us come into our own until later in life, if ever at all. The opinions of others are whipping us into a frenzy of following along or rebellion. Yet even rebels act like other rebels. There are two levels taking place. Rebelling against the status quo, quote-unquote the man, while needing desperately to fit into the community of rebels. I've yet to meet a person who didn't want to fit in or be a part of some kind of community. The reaction we have to what others think of us is extremely visceral, and is one of the reasons that public speaking often ranks higher on the fear litmus test, so to speak, than death. The fear of being ostracized is worse than death. The fear of being cast out is worse than death. The fear of being forgotten is the same. When people develop habits that don't serve them or that they don't want, it's always, always because the subconscious mind believes it's helping them, somehow saving them and protecting them from something worse. We need to stop seeing our nail-biting, fear of flying, or chronic procrastination as a failure of our character, but instead as a series of neural wires clumped together in a way that doesn't help us. You can become aware of what's happening and say to yourself, there's a connection in my brain that I no longer want to have. It was built through repetition, or chakra trauma, and it can be unbuilt. This habit was built, so it can be unbuilt. Repeat that in your mind along with me. This habit was built, so it can be unbuilt. In fact, by bringing my awareness to this fact, I'm already beginning to unbuild it. Once you can step back and see this as a construct of your brain, rather than an innate issue that you're doomed to suffer with for the rest of time, the emotional charge dissipates. The guilt, fear, and doubt subside. It isn't necessarily our fault that we developed these habits in the first place, but it's our sole responsibility to change the firing of neurons in our brain if we want to have a different life experience. Human brain development is created through complex interactions of genetic and environmental influences. While there are volumes written about how habits are created in the brain and how unique environments impact everything from obesity rates to ADHD to SAT scores and more, what we will focus on is how you develop the habits you no longer want. Let's begin at the beginning, your childhood. Childhood development. I shared Jill's story at the beginning of this chapter. What stood out to me was that she actively struggled with nail biting every day as an adult. However, when she was regressed to the source of the issue, it was inside her kindergarten classroom. During the session, it was as if little Jilly Bean was still sitting right there, her heart breaking as her teacher reprimanded her for something she had not done and then making her art a source of ridicule. All the emotions were as fresh as if they were happening in the present moment, and for good reason. Under the age of 7, our brain operates almost entirely at the level of the theta brainwave state. When you're in this state, you're pure creativity and imagination. There are no inhibitions. Kids play their imaginary games, dance, and cry and laugh hysterically in this state. They don't care who sees or judges them. Our mind elicits a number of different brain wavelengths, and though we'll discuss this at length in Chapter 4, let's go over the basics now. There's beta, which is our normal thinking state of consciousness. There's alpha, which is light daydreaming and which allows us to be more creative. And then there's the theta brainwave state, which is a trance-like state of hypnosis. Finally, there's delta, which is sleep. In young children, the alpha and beta brainwave states aren't fully developed yet. Imagine a young child in a grocery store hearing her favorite song. She starts to dance with all of her heart. It's because she hasn't developed what we might call the ego, which comes from some of those faster-moving brainwaves, such as the beta state. Now imagine a 12-year-old in the same situation. It's highly unlikely the child would start dancing. Children that age would be mortified if anybody saw them being silly. So when Picasso said that to be a great artist, you have to paint like a child, he was in essence saying that we need to access the theta brainwave state so that our inhibitions are reduced. Quote, "It took me 4 years to paint like Raphael, but a lifetime to paint like a child." End quote, Pablo Picasso. The theta state is also when you're most open to suggestion. Imagine a child you know under the age of 7 years old. They're little sponges running around, soaking up everything they see and hear. Most of our worldview is formed before the age of 7. The way we see ourselves, the skills we think we have, what we believe we're capable of, what we believe we deserve, how we identify within our community, and how we identify within our family. I can't begin to tell you how many of my clients say, "I'm terrified of public speaking and I have no idea why." After we complete a couple of hypnosis sessions, I witness them going back to an early moment at home or in school, like Jill, when someone made fun of them or a figure of authority told them they were stupid. As adults, we wouldn't necessarily think of that as a traumatizing event, but neurological associations are created at the time they happen. So let's say you're 6 years old and you make a painting for your father on Father's Day, to which he responds, "What's this crap?" It's a traumatic, deeply embarrassing, and painful experience for you and can shape your beliefs about your own ability to be creative forever or inhibit your desire to share your creativity with the world. It might even be a factor in how you relate to other human beings, eventually developing into social anxiety. The way the brain deals with disappointment is a result of these early events in our life. Now, parents, I know you're wondering if every little thing you say to your children under the age of 7 is going to scar them forever. Not at all. Not every moment of every day will have the same kind of impact on us for the rest of our life. It's simply helpful to understand how subconscious programming develops at a young age and to do our best. For example, a hypnotherapist I heard at a conference mentioned during his keynote that one day his son came home from school in hysterics because someone had broken his toy in half, and it was his favorite toy. He just couldn't believe that person could be so mean. As a hypnotherapist, he was able to recognize the importance of this experience and see it as a pivotal defining moment. This could possibly forever define my child's beliefs and understanding about other human beings and how to interact with them, he said. Some parents might just say, "What are you crying about? Don't worry about it. You have 100 million other toys," and move on with their day. But taking those few minutes to recognize what could be fundamentally shaping our beliefs for the rest of our life is very important. In this particular case, the hypnotherapist helped to reframe the experience by immediately going out to buy a new toy, which they anchored to the importance of forgiveness. What could have been a lasting traumatic experience for the little boy became just another day. Also, just to be clear, the way to avoid a child's potential negative subconscious programming doesn't necessarily include buying them a new toy. There are plenty of ways to anchor a positive message into the subconscious mind, and in this instance, replacing a lost item was a powerful way to do that, but it's certainly not the only way. Subconscious programming, environment, elders, and entertainment. There are many ways in which our subconscious mind is programmed, which can result in habits that serve us, hurt us, or limit us. For the sake of clarity, I have grouped the most common sources of our negative subconscious programming into the three E's, environment, elders, and entertainment. Understanding how we developed our nasty habits in the first place allows us to actively reprogram our subconscious with better habits so that our programming actually serves us in a positive way. The cornerstone of hypnotherapy is the knowledge and ability to weed out what limits us and plant what helps us in its place. The first E, environment. Our environment is one of the primary sources of our programming and can be positive or negative depending on various factors, such as where we were born, what kind of family we had, the customs and norms of our community, and our socioeconomic condition, just to name a few. As mentioned, our language, accents, shared agreement on what's rude or acceptable behavior, clothing, and even hygiene regimens are not innate. They're learned through our environment. For example, my college roommate, Justina, is still a good friend, and we often laugh at the idea that her grandmother used to lovingly yell at her that she wouldn't be able to conceive any children if she sat on anything too cold. She wasn't supposed to sit on steps outside her apartment building on a cold day, for instance. Justina was far enough removed from her native Poland to see the humor that I, as a foreigner, saw in her grandmother's old-world belief. But nonetheless, as we inched closer to our 30s, Justina couldn't help herself. She would laugh as she found herself tugging on my arm, pulling me upward to keep me from sitting on any cold surface. Even when we know our customs are programmed, it just feels right to go along with them and wrong when we don't. Is this because black cats or walking under ladders are actually bad luck? No, it's because our neurons were wired to feel a certain way about predominant beliefs found in our culture from a very young age. Understanding groupthink. Groupthink is the phenomenon behind why groups of people start to think collectively with one agenda or set of beliefs. The goal is creating and maintaining unity instead of being open and objective to various opinions, solutions, or alternatives. The group's actions tend to be unreasonable and amplify their moral rightness and social positions. The individual's critical thinking and reasoning skills are abandoned. These beliefs are usually created in isolation, where similar backgrounds add to their destructive thinking. A horrific example of groupthink in action is Nazi Germany, where the government and millions of soldiers and citizens collectively sought to create a quote-unquote pure race for Germany by exterminating everyone who didn't meet their criteria. It's difficult to understand how human beings could turn a blind eye to such atrocities, but groupthink helps explain and better understand how the group's collective thinking takes over individual reason and even human compassion. Cults are also often a prime example of groupthink theory in practice. Maybe some members of the cult feel that something is off-putting or morally wrong, but if they don't speak up, it's because they believe to oppose the common mindset of how things are supposed to be would have worse repercussions than going along. Understanding groupthink adds to the conversation about how we develop our nasty habits and even act in ways that go against our own moral compass. We've come to understand that groupthink is one of the ways in which everyday people seem to be able to commit atrocities, but we can also apply the same thought process to the development of our more benign habits. By studying groupthink, we can more easily understand how a mother who tells her children, "We're just not good at math in this family," could result in a family who isn't good at math. Her children may all experience heightened anxiety during math exams and might assume they're not going to get into a certain college due to their math SAT scores. They might not even apply for jobs where statistics or analytics are required, all because of a subconscious belief that to go against the group, to go against the accepted idea that the entire family is bad at math, would make them an outcast and an outsider. The survival instinct kicks in, and even though consciously it would make sense to excel in math if possible, the subconscious clings to the familial groupthink in order to be accepted. To the subconscious, acceptance equals survival, and we will often act in our own worst interest if there is a perceived choice to be made between fitting in or getting kicked out of the group. A place where this shows up quite a bit is in making more money than one's parents, and even in breaking the pattern of obesity in a family. The second E, elders. The second primary source of subconscious programming is our elders. Something very important to keep in mind is that under the age of 7, we're nearly pure subconscious, meaning we're open to suggestion with a lack of inhibition. The conscious mind has not yet developed, and we're little sponges absorbing everything. That isn't to say that everything we experience during childhood becomes a habit, but what we experience with repetition and/or during a heightened state of emotion can stick and forever shape who we become. We'll discuss this further in Chapter 5, but as a quick primer, the same brain waves being produced during a deep hypnosis session, theta brain waves, are what we produce almost exclusively under the age of 7. This means we're in a relative state of hypnosis throughout childhood. It would be difficult to learn how to be human, how to speak, and so on, if we were unable to access our subconscious mind readily. What this also means is the people we perceive to be authority figures during that time of our life, parents, guardians, older siblings, teachers, have an even greater influence on our overall subconscious programming. Jill's story is a perfect example of this. I was taught throughout my studies in hypnotherapy that approximately 1/3 of our developed habits are a direct rebellion against our parents, guardian, or most dominant authority figure in our life, and 2/3 of our developed habits are a result of mimicking our parents. We either rebel or mimic, and our subconscious mind doesn't know any different path than to either be the same as our parents or to be the exact opposite of them. An interesting component of the power of suggestion is that beliefs and habits are absorbed more readily when the person making the suggestion is perceived to be an authority figure. In hypnosis, there tends to be a correlation between efficacy and just how much the client views the hypnotherapist as an expert. This led to the development of authoritarian or paternal styles of hypnotherapy, which included the hypnotherapist employing tools to make them in the dominant position. For example, a hypnotist would ask someone to change the position he or she is seated in, or touch the client in a way that shows dominance, or would shout such commands as sleep, techniques which are ridiculous and unnecessary. Eventually, this method gave way to what we now refer to as permissive or Ericksonian hypnosis, largely developed by and popularized by Milton Erickson. This method is referred to as the maternal style of hypnosis. This authority figure mechanism is why in hypnotherapy school, we are advised to never work with our own parents. Parents would need to overcome a deeply embedded belief that they themselves are the authority figure in the relationship and would need to give way to a new belief that their child is the expert. For example, even if my mother is proud of me for being an expert in my field, to her, I will always be her little girl. Therefore, any suggestions I make during a hypnosis session will be seen through this lens, potentially rendering the session less effective. The inverse is true when we view someone to have a great deal of authority. For example, when a doctor flippantly gives the worst-case scenario to a patient with no regard for the vulnerability of that patient's subconscious mind. Quote-unquote, it could be cancer, versus, we need to do more tests right away, still conveys urgency without sending the client into a tailspin that could ultimately result in further health issues simply due to panic, worry, and obsession over an inconclusive diagnosis. Even simple changes from, you may feel pressure, to, this might hurt a little, can change everything. In the former phrase, the patient is prepared for a procedure with words that are relatively soothing, whereas the second option causes the subconscious mind to hear, hurt, hurt, hurt. Then the body instantly tenses up. In summary, the way we perceive authority figures in our life, especially when we're children, deeply impacts the development of our habits. The third E, entertainment. The third primary source of programming is entertainment, which is really divided into two categories, media and advertising. We're all aware of how powerful and impactful the media can be. However, in the context of this conversation, Some of the most common ramifications of the media on the subconscious mind have to do with our devastating self-criticism. In a fascinating yet heartbreaking study, Harvard professor Anne E. Becker measured the effect of television on cultural norms. As you hear the results, keep in mind that television was only catching on in Fiji in 1995, and that a decade before, even electricity was rare. As reported at thoughtmedicine.com, the results were startling. In 1995, without television, girls in Fiji appeared to be free of the eating disorders common in the West. But by 1998, after just a few years of sexy soap operas and seductive commercials, 11.3% of adolescent girls reported they at least once had purged to lose weight. To illustrate this rapid transformation of ideals, Becker quoted from the 1998 interviews. "I want their body," said one girl of the Western shows she watched. "I want their size." By the glow of television, young girls in Fiji got the idea they could re-sculpt their lives, said Becker. But they also began to, quote, think of themselves as poor and fat. In 2007, Becker found that disordered eating habits were alive and well in Fiji, with 45% of girls reporting they had purged in the last month. In some cases, they got traditional herbal purgatives from their mothers. On the other side of the globe, my wise, wonderful Nana shared with me a similar experience. At the time of writing this, my Nana is as bright and beautiful as ever at 100 years old, and I love asking her about what life was like back in her day. She told me that when she was a child, she tended to be very happy, in large part due to the fact that she wasn't aware of what she didn't have. Born in 1917 in Belfast, Ireland, she didn't see glossy magazines telling her what her body should look like. Without television, there weren't any advertisements for gadgets, clothes, houses, and vacations to show her all that her family couldn't afford. Everyone wore clothes from the same stores and had the same simple toys. The people who had more lived in an entirely different part of town and went to different schools. So the crushing weight of constant comparison and coming up short didn't exist for her, and her subconscious wasn't shaped by lack. Of course, Nana had her fair share of challenges growing up during extremely turbulent times in Northern Ireland, but the bombardment of advertising leading to self-criticism wasn't a part of it. Today, the concept of beauty has become askew in a way that's harmful to many girls and women. Most of my weight loss clients hold themselves up to photos of supermodels in magazines, which have been photoshopped for hours. Media also shapes what we believe is possible as far as overcoming our existing challenges. Movies continue to portray stereotypes, and we unconsciously compare ourselves to them. Luckily, this is all common knowledge now, yet it doesn't diminish how destructive these influences are. Movies themselves are kind of hypnotic, aren't they? When you watch a movie, you bypass the critical factor of the mind, which is one of the definitions of hypnosis. For example, someone finds a magic potion and drinks it, and now the person can fly. The conscious mind would say, "That's impossible. I've never seen someone fly before." Yet you suspend your disbelief and go along with what you're seeing because you know anything can happen in a movie. The problem is that the subconscious mind can't tell the difference between what's real and what's imaginary. It also can't tell the difference between real emotions and quote-unquote fake emotions, such as crying as you watch a tragic movie scene versus crying during a real-life tragedy. To the subconscious, your heart is broken and you're crying. Similarly, the subconscious can't tell the difference between real and perceived stress. When you're about to be actually attacked or you're simply panicking about getting a report into your boss on time, your subconscious just perceives it as stress, fight, flight, or freeze time. At the movies, you're looking up at a screen, and when your eyes become tired, the rest of your body relaxes. This is one of the reasons that some old-school hypnotists used to use a swinging pocket watch. While watching the watch swing back and forth, the eyes tire quickly, which relaxes the body quickly. making it easier to enter into the meditative state of hypnosis. Unfortunately, the swinging watch was used in so many movies and posters with a creepy cloaked dude leaning over a starry-eyed waif of a woman that the swinging watch has its own bizarre connotations today. Luckily for us, swinging watches aren't a requirement. Looking up at a diagonal has the same tiring effect. Just think about sitting in church and looking up at the pulpits. So during a movie, you're looking up at the screen, and you're in a state of focused attention. A common definition of hypnosis is a relaxed, focused state of concentration. When you're watching a movie, you're not thinking about the fact that your taxes are due in 2 days. You're completely immersed in the story. Then, when the credits start to roll, you start to think about all the things you still have to do for the rest of the day. It's almost instantaneous that the hypnotic state is over. Anecdotally, another example is highway hypnosis, where we enter a relaxed, focused state of concentration while driving on the highway. Before we know it, we're sitting in our driveway asking, "How did I get here so fast?" When considering that we're in a hypnotic state, therefore more suggestible while at the movies or watching TV, it could give us pause to consider what we're ingesting for hours on end. Imagine a 6-year-old you watching every movie and television show. What would you censor yourself from, especially now knowing what you do about the suggestible theta state of that age? In an instant, we can change how we perceive ourselves, how we perceive our world, and how we shape our hopes and dreams by changing what entertainment we spend time watching. What a wonderful drastic shift there would be in our society if more positive entertainment was developed by conscious creatives. While it may seem daunting to ask this of Hollywood, every time you purchase a movie ticket, you vote for what you want to see. Every time you contribute to ratings by how much and how long you watch a Netflix show, you're voting. Consider the impact these programs and movies have on your subconscious beliefs, and allow that to impact where you spend your money and your time. The second portion of entertainment is advertising, which typically reaches us through the use of media. It's important to recognize the persuasive power of advertising companies. We clearly saw this in the 1990s when tobacco companies were banned from advertising to teenagers. Prior to the ban, the advertising subliminally targeted teen consumers with bright colors on the cigarette packets, flavored cigarettes that adolescents preferred, and language that teens used. To varying degrees, advertisers have always used sex and the prospect of sex to sell just about any product available on the market. Commercials of women in bikinis or short shorts eating hamburgers for fast food franchises or falling in love with men who wear certain colognes are the norm. This advertising has proven to be successful because it affects the subconscious mind. Does that mean we're being brainwashed every time we see commercials that we run out like zombies to purchase the product? No. Again, hypnosis is only truly effective when you want the result. According to Psychology Today, while a surprising number of people today still subscribe to the idea that subliminal advertising can make us do things against our will, that's largely just a myth. Research has shown that subliminal ads and other stimuli designed to influence us outside our awareness can do so, but not very powerfully. That's one of the reasons that marketing to the wrong person is so expensive. That person doesn't want the result you're promising, so those ad dollars are flushed down the drain. Let's say you reach your target demo head-on, but they're still being bombarded by your competitors' ads. Advertising companies know it takes a long time for those neurons that fire together to also wire together and make the association that purchasing the product will release the greatest surge of serotonin. It's why customer service is so important. One emotionally charged bad experience causes a new strong neural pathway and a customer lost forever. It isn't that we have to fear making purchases without any willpower, but we reclaim our power when we recognize we're being targeted and that advertising companies want us to feel negatively about ourselves so that we'll buy more stuff to fill the void. Buying into their messages about what perfect legs look like in no way serves us. It's time to learn how to close your eyes, get free, so that the self-criticism stops. The good, the bad, and the familiar. The subconscious mind doesn't differentiate between what's good for you and what's bad for you. It differentiates between what's familiar and what's new. Unless we're accessing the theta state as an adult using hypnosis, or are under the age of 7, anything new gets blocked. This is the way I have described it to my new clients. Imagine there's a nightclub. The conscious mind is the bouncer, and the subconscious mind is all of the people inside the nightclub. Everyone inside the club is smoking cigarettes. Someone who isn't smoking, but who is drinking a glass of water, goes up to the bouncer and asks to go in. The bouncer says no. The non-smoker says, "But I can really help everyone in there. I've read all these books on what's healthy, and I want to share it with them." The bouncer says, "You don't fit in. You're unfamiliar. I have no idea whether you're going to help us or hurt us. I've no idea whether it would be safe to change what we've been doing for so long inside here, so no, you can't come in." With hypnotherapy, it's as if we tip the bouncer $100 to let us in so that we can grab the microphone and tell everyone what we know about cigarettes. Now that the subconscious can hear us, it can begin to shift and change. Now that we're interacting directly with the subconscious, we can actually change it. Once we've had our say in the nightclub, people start putting down their cigarettes and pick up water. Before you know it, everyone inside is drinking water. So from that point forward, if someone comes up to the bouncer, the conscious mind, with a cigarette and says, "Hey, can I get in there?" The bouncer will say, "No, you don't fit in." You can use the same analogy and replace the cigarettes with unhealthy food. The guy at the door is holding a kale salad. Or the new guy at the door is holding deep, relaxing sleep while everyone inside is an insomniac. The reason for this is it takes a lot of energy to learn something new. A Medical Daily article entitled "How Habits Are Formed and Why They're So Hard to Change" sums it up very well. Quote, "There is a dual mind at play. Our minds don't always integrate in the best way possible. Even when you know the right answer, you can't make yourself change the habitual behavior. Habits are formed after a person has learned something new, like how to parallel park. There's a cue or trigger which signals to your brain to turn a behavior into an automatic routine, parallel parking, followed by the actual routine of the behavior, each time someone finds him or herself in New York City. And then the reward. The reward is the brain's own personal cue for when it should recall the automatic behavior. Once that happens, the brain takes a break. In fact, the brain starts working less and less. The brain can almost completely shut down. And this is a real advantage because it means you have all of this mental activity you can devote to something else. If you're not thinking about what you're doing because it's automatic, how can you possibly change bad habits?" End quote. Luckily, with the use of hypnosis, we can speed up the process of creating new habits and breaking down old ones. Let's get started with this chapter's script. Self-hypnosis process. Self-worth. You can find the written version of the script in the PDF that comes with your program. I suggest reading through the directions 2 or 3 times so that you will easily remember what to do once you close your eyes and get free. While listening to the audio version, you can just close your eyes, sit back, and relax as you follow along. However, please never listen to hypnosis while driving. If you're driving right now, please skip ahead to the next chapter and come back to follow along with this self-hypnosis process once you're in a safe place. Also remember, video tutorials and audio recordings are available to you at www.closeyoureyesgetfree.com that will help you become a self-hypnosis pro in no time at all. Begin by making note of your starting stress level. 10 equals a full-blown panic attack, and 0 equals 0 stress. No stress at all. the most relaxed a person can possibly be. Remember this number. Sit in a comfortable chair and place your feet on the ground, resting your hands gently in your lap. With your spine straight but comfortable and your eyes closed, take 4 deep, slow breaths, inhaling through your nose for 4 counts and exhaling through your nose for 8 counts. In, 2, 3, 4. Out, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. In, 2, 3, 4. Out, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. In, 2, 3, 4. Out, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. In, 2, 3, 4. Out, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. With your eyes still closed, imagine gentle roots growing from the bottom of your feet down into the center of the earth, grounding you. Good. Repeating in your mind after me, count down from 10 to 1, saying, I am going deeper and deeper after each number. Let's begin. 10. I am going deeper and deeper. 9. I am going deeper and deeper. 8. I am going deeper and deeper. 7. I am going deeper and deeper. 6. I am going deeper and deeper. 5. I am going deeper and deeper. 4. I am going deeper and deeper. 3. I am going deeper and deeper. 2. I am going deeper and deeper. 1. I am going deeper and deeper. Take another nice, deep, letting go breath and repeat silently in your mind or out loud after me the following hypno affirmations. Every day, in every way, I love myself more and more. Every day, in every way, I am more and more proud of myself. Every day, in every way, I am more and more kind to myself. Every day, in every way, I love myself more and more. Every day, in every way, I am more and more proud of myself. Every day, in every way, I am more and more kind to myself. Every day, in every way, I love myself more and more. Every day, in every way, I am more and more proud of myself. Every day, in every way, I am more and more kind to myself. I love myself more and more. I am more and more proud of myself. I am more and more kind to myself. I love myself more and more. I am more and more proud of myself. I am more and more kind to myself. I love myself more and more. I am more and more proud of myself. I am more and more kind to myself. I love myself. I am proud of myself. I am kind to myself. I love myself. I am proud of myself. I am kind to myself. I love myself. I am proud of myself. I am kind to myself. Take another nice, deep, letting go breath. With your eyes still closed, imagine being kind and loving toward yourself for the rest of your day until you curl up into bed tonight. Pretend in your mind that you can see yourself thinking positive, loving thoughts about yourself. Imagine yourself smiling at your reflection in a mirror and congratulating yourself on a job well done while at work, or gifting yourself a mani-pedi, and so on. Do that now. Good. Now that you've spent a few moments imagining the rest of your day filled with kind and loving thoughts and actions towards yourself, put a gentle smile on your lips, open your eyes, stretch your arms over the top of your head, and say yes. Notice your new number on the scale. Remember 0 equals 0 stress, the most relaxed you can be, and congratulate yourself on how quickly you improved your state. Here's a simple summary for the process. Notice starting stress level from 0 to 10. 4 deep breaths. Grow roots. Count down saying, I am going deeper and deeper. Repeat variations of the hypnoaffirmations. Every day in every way I love myself more and more. Every day in every way I'm more and more proud of myself. Every day in every way I'm more and more kind to myself. Imagine being kind and loving towards yourself for the rest of the day. Smile, open your eyes, and say yes. Notice your new number on the scale from 0 to 10. Congratulate yourself for improving your state so quickly. In this more advanced self-hypnosis process, you may have noticed that the hypnoaffirmations became shorter over time. Let's take a look at why. Why do we shorten these hypnoaffirmations over time? For most people, repeating, I love myself, will be, at the very least, a slightly jarring new experience. For many, repeating, I love myself, for the first time, could actually be a very upsetting experience, because the pain in your chest that accompanies it will indicate just how much it isn't true. Most people think negative, even hateful thoughts about themselves all day long. To immediately switch that up and begin affirming, I love myself, I'm proud of myself, I'm kind to myself, would result in the loud blaring of our BS detectors, which is not what we want. Hypnosis can certainly be aspirational, but it does need to be at least moderately believable to be effective. A fantastic mechanism to begin shifting our thoughts is to add, every day and every way I am more and more. This way, the subconscious just has to believe that we are learning to love ourselves, we are learning to be proud of ourselves, and so on. And simply because of the fact that you are listening to this audiobook, you know this is true. That being said, repeating every day and every way I love myself more and more is a mouthful, as opposed to the more concise and power-packed, I love myself. In this self-hypnosis script, we begin with what is most believable to the subconscious mind, and over time transition into what is both more powerful and easier to remember. If you find yourself having a lot of resistance to these particular affirmations for increasing self-worth, stick with the every day and every way I am more and more version until you feel comfortable with them, and only then move on to the more concise version. Eventually, you'll be able to look yourself in the mirror and say out loud, I love you exactly as you are, without flinching, knowing you mean it, and having your subconscious support you in that powerful belief. Why do we imagine gentle roots growing from the bottom of our feet down into the center of the earth? I find that the vast majority of my clients spend countless hours on the phone and in front of brightly lit computer or tablet screens, shuttling between home and the office day after day, with very little time spent outdoors connecting to nature. Simply walking on grass can have a very grounding, calming effect on our nervous system. And what's the next best thing to actually getting outside and digging our toes into the ground? Imagining it. Those roots are simply sending